Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Well, very nice to make your acquaintance, Jason.
Likewise, Mr. Jones. Do you know that song, Talking Heads song?
No, I don't.
I noticed right away, which is pretty much the impression I got right away, is that you're quite an extrovert.
Yeah, I'd say that. Yeah, I'm an extrovert. That's true.
Yeah. That might be a first for this podcast, though. I might be overstating it, but...
Okay.
That's good.
Fair enough. I read your book, actually. I felt like I should tell you that straight up. The Prisoner of Infinity, the one about Whitley Strieber.
Wow. Not many people have read that, have been able or willing or ready.
Well, I liked it. I mean, I really liked the central conceit of it, I guess, that... and excuse me if I get it wrong, but sort of that, trauma kind of splits us in two and kind of creates like a guardian and then something for the guardian to protect, and it kind of makes this like hellish double world for everybody. Or, some people who have this experience happen to them, I guess.
Well, so that's not so much my premise as... And even where I got it from was Donald Cowshed, and
okay.
Even he, I don't suppose, would give himself credit for coming up with the model. I guess it's a very long-term psychological... the result of many, many decades of psychological observation of what we do. It became, over the last few years, a real central fascination for me, this whole area of trauma and dissociation and how it overlaps with creativity and pop culture, fantasy escapism, just that whole nexus, if you will, of where the lines have been blurred.
One thing that I wondered about reading it was, when exactly did you start getting into it? Because it seemed like you're kind of a completist. I feel like you read everything this guy ever wrote.
I did once. I started writing that piece because it became... an entirely different thing. I was like a detective on a case, right? I got to find all the evidence and look at all the clues. And so I ended up going back into Whitleyville. But I'd been into Whitley Strieber from quite a young age. Well, not that young. I mean, not relative. I know somebody who was 8 when they first read that book. But I was in my 20s, so it wasn't really that early. But I had over a decade of just being fully sold to his account and his narrative, and it, as I talk about in Prisoner of Infinity, it gave kind of structure and meaning and context to a lot of my experiences for a while.
Yeah.
Until I began to see that it wasn't an adequate framework by which to understand them, and so then that kind of went hand in hand with becoming more aware of my own fragmented nature, let's say.
All right. I mean, what led you to him in the first place? Like, what was the first book you read? What was like the thing that got you sort of in? How do you hear about him, I guess? Like,
I'm going to answer that, but I was distracted because you gave me video.
Oh, and
by this upside down horse. Because that's a fascinating artifact, particularly because I'm a Horsley.
Oh, yeah. No, I got that. This art gallery was cleaning stuff out. They're downstairs from where I work, and they had a bunch of shit, and I picked up the horse and this...
And the mouse? Is that a mouse?
It's a My Little Pony in bondage gear.
Okay.
So... Video. Yeah.
And what do the letters say? I can see vibe. It looks like I can see
it says eel vibe. I found these letters downstairs. I guess, you know, they spell out believe if you put them all in order correctly. But eel vibe made the most sense to me, I guess. So it says
eel vibe. Yeah. The eel has come out recently, actually, for me, a couple of times. I can't remember the second time, very recently, but then previously was this writer, John Taylor Gatto, who's describing the Fabian infiltration of the whole education system. And he was saying, you can't think of it as hunting conspiracies. You have to think of it as microchipping an eel so that you can see the holes that he's made when he's been journeying through the... I can't remember the exact quote, but... He used an eel as a metaphor for, like, memes, you know, how they...
Yeah, sure.
Ideologies and memes and how they penetrate our culture.
The way they live in coral, I guess, which is organic, but then you have this monster inside them.
Yeah.
Swimming around. Yeah, I mean, Whitley Strieber's, just to get back to it, it's interesting to me, of course, because he's from Texas, I guess, and that's where I'm from, and, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, writers from Texas who have penetrated... I guess the greater cultural marketplace or whatever. So you got Whitley Strieber and Robert Howard, who wrote Conan, Patricia Highsmith, and you know, a few others. Wes Anderson, I guess, these days. But so I'm always curious about what exactly gets sold about Texas. You know, what are the myths and archetypes that we're putting out there in the world? You know.
Right, and Gary's from Texas too. That came up on our conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that about Highsmith. She's one of my favorite writers, actually.
Yeah, right next to Dallas, I believe she grew up.
But, huh.
She definitely moved to Europe as soon as she could.
Yeah, you wouldn't guess it with Highsmith. There's no residue of Texas. Whereas with Strieber, he's very much he's got this persona that is. I don't know if it's exactly Texas, but it's very sort of broad American kind of.
I've never read any of his work, but now, you know, I'm compelled to from reading your book about him. I guess I'm curious about where to start if somebody was interested. What would be a good book to pick up?
Well, with Strieber, I guess the place to start would be where you started with Prisoner Infinity, because then I would hope that you would have been inoculated at that point.
That's Prisoner of Infinity by Jason Horton at Crucial Fictions.
Right. And then if you still want to read Whitley at that, and I'm glad if people want to read him more, and if they weren't interested and now they are, then that proves it disproves Whitley's own feelings that I'm, you know, out to get him, or I'm trying to expose, or any of that business. It's not really about that. It's about finding a deeper context for work, and I think it makes this work much more interesting. So anyway, Communion would be the obvious place to start.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, that was when his, and I find this fascinating too as a general subject to look at. He changed horses midstream. He went from a horror fiction writer, well, before that he changed even more radically because he was in the advertising business, but anyway, he became a fiction writer who was very successful. He wrote Wolfen and The Hunger, and they became Hollywood movies, so he was making a good living as a fiction writer, and then he had a few novels that didn't sell so well, and then he suddenly came out with Communion, which was a non-fiction account that was as horrifying as any of his horror novels had been.
Right. And your thesis is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean he was lying in order to make cash.
No.
He was in some ways processing things even more truthfully by doing this, whether it was true or not, you know, the experiences. He was actually getting to the root of why he was writing at all, why he was a creator and why he created the sort of things he did.
Yeah, and the way that we make narratives out of our experience. I was talking to another of Gary's clients. I don't know if you know him, William Gillespie. Do you know that writer?
Don't say not.
Okay. So we were talking about this yesterday. I think it was with him. My God, I talked to so many people about how narratives is a biological function. Like, it's more than just that we get culturally conditioned by stories as children and all the rest of it to want to make everything into stories, that it's actually part of our biology, the way that consciousness works, is it turns things into narratives. So then a writer, of course, has that squared, you know, has that syndrome much more accentuated. For whatever reason, I would argue that trauma, if trauma does lead to dissociation, that's a kind of, you know, going into creating these fantasies, using the raw material of reality or of consciousness to escape something unbearable. So if we're traumatized early on, we're more likely to become storytellers, fiction writers, creative people, you know, fantasists. So I think Strieber's a really good case study of that. Like, he developed this disability or this trade for creating narratives unconsciously as a way to deal with trauma. And then when the trauma started to become more conscious, then his storytelling abilities really kicked in. So it wasn't as though he was fabricating more, but he was getting closer to the wound, and so the fabrication became more obvious because, in a way, this is a bit paradoxical, because he was writing non-fiction. I mean, nobody's going to criticize fiction for saying, well, this bit isn't true or that bit's not true.
Sure.
You know, you just take the whole thing and you, as it is. But when you present something as he does, as ipso facto non-fiction, you're making a claim that it's going to be questioned. And so at one extreme, he got accused of what you were saying, of being the, of just doing it for a buck, which is absolutely untrue. And the other extreme, people just believed it completely, and even began to interpret their own experiences of whatever it is that's going on through the lens that he'd provided them.
And I'm sure that was hellishly uncomfortable for him. I mean, because you're, well, you know, I don't know. On one hand, all these people believing in you are validating your experience and to, like, a degree that's, you know, but that's what makes you the prisoner of infinity, right? You know, and how do you get away from that without telling them all that, you know, you were not able to be completely truthful because your experience is so messed up by whatever trauma you had in you?
I don't think he's ready to look at that.
Yeah. Well, an important book, you know. I feel like he's got a raw deal because nobody, like David Copperfield, for instance, right? That's a Dickens' most autobiographical work. I'm a big Dickens fan.
Yeah.
And it's, in some ways, you know, right, ripped from the pages of his life, you know, and it's got the same kind of relationship to trauma. I mean, who had more trauma in their life than Charles Dickens, right, you know?
I don't know, actually, about him that much.
Well, you know, had a terrible upbringing, was...
Poverty, yeah.
Yeah, poverty, but also somehow even worse, he was, like, you know, lower middle class and then reduced to upper lower class, you know? And how do you recover from that? I mean, I don't know. But, so he was working for a living as a kid, and, you know, terrible misfortunes, obviously, but David Copperfield's kind of a wry and witty look at his life, but it's, you know, obviously heavily fictionalized. But you can see where, in writing that, he was trying to do some damage control or, you know, understand what had happened to him in a way that was also able to make a living at. And, you know, it's his best work. It's genius, you know, like a lot of things he did. And I feel like something like Communion is similar, although, of course, I haven't read it. But I really think the onus is on us for needing that. And this is also another thesis in your book, for needing that split between fiction and nonfiction, for really wanting one thing to be either or, you know, for me to be either completely true or completely false. Without and that, by doing that, you're just eliminating writers altogether. You know,
right? Well, that's true. That's an interesting thesis right there. And because technically it's not true, because writers continue to do it, but we let ourselves get compartmentalized in that way.
Right, yeah. So, I don't know. Good book, Jason. I liked it.
Well, thanks. You only read half of it, by the way. That was part one that's online. Part two is for my eyes only, apparently, this time, because I'm still sulking about the lack of interest. Not really. I want it to come out at the right time, in the right place, in the right way, and But anyway, yes, I'm very happy whenever I hear that somebody's read it. I'm very surprised that you would read it as preparation for today, because it's quite a commitment, that series of essays.
Well, you know, it's all stuff that I already find kind of inherently interesting. Stuff like, you know, the Process Church and Scientology, and I mean, it's, you know, the horrible occult fabric of the 20th century, the tapestry we all sort of are enmeshed in. So it's kind of interesting to see another thread there.
Right. Okay. Well, that's definitely something we can talk about, because I've read some of your stuff, but certainly by no means the equivalent. And one of your interviews, and so I've got a very, very limited sense of what you're doing. So, and I didn't get that. I didn't realize that you were particularly interested in the horrible occult fabric of the 20th century, if I'm quoting you correctly there. Although it makes sense if Gary pointed me to you, because Gary and I certainly connected over that. So tell me more about your interest and how it developed and how it manifests in your own work.
Well, I wouldn't say it's manifested in my own work, but, you know, I like history. I like history a great deal. I mean, history is probably my favorite thing. I'm just in life. I love it. And it's really enriching and gives me great pleasure, mainly for the reason we mentioned. The split between true and false is real, you know, tenuous a lot of the time. And, so, and a great book of history kind of turns reality into a better story than events that take place. And the occult version of the 20th century, all the occult stuff that happens, gives us a bad guy, right? It makes the 20th century into an even more fascinating, I guess, like, you know, good v evil story, which I don't know if I buy completely, but it certainly adds a lot to your understanding of things. It enriches it's like a compendium that makes everything just a little more, you know, nasty, but also puts meaning in places where maybe it doesn't exist, but where you see, when you see it, it definitely illumines things. And, you know, every now and then you just get, like, you know, some facts that come out that, you know, everybody agrees on, or you know, and they are shit that people who are in the margins have been saying for years, you know, and it's like, well, all right then. You know, maybe we got to take this stuff more seriously. You know, what is the relationship between these things? So
where did your interest, or how did it begin in occult history?
How did it begin? I guess probably college, getting internet access. You know, so all of a sudden you have high speed internet access and not much else to do. And, you know, there's a tendency among people who are cult-minded to put all their research up in giant chunks and have it be like, because they want to be taken seriously, right, more than anybody, so you have these big, like, dumps of you know, like Operation Clambake, I guess, for Scientology. And
yeah, these, and this would have been when, roughly?
I graduated college in 2003, so
it was well established by that time, the conspiracy culture. Obviously, the internet was, but pointing out, they kind of grew up hand in hand. Because when I first got into stuff, which was Castaneda and then Crowley and then Strieber a little bit later, they could almost be the big three. There was no internet. But Castaneda led pretty quickly. Well, Castaneda got me to Mexico, learning Spanish, want to become a brujo, that whole thing. That became my life for a period. But that very quickly, I went to San Francisco from Mexico for a brief trip, and I discovered May Brussels and the whole conspiracy, pre-internet conspiracy subculture. And I took to it like a fish to water. I mean, I didn't have any trouble, probably like yourself, I didn't have any trouble believing any of it, not to say that I was completely gullible either, but just like, oh, they killed John Lennon, sure, why not? and so on, whatever it was. Jonestown was CIA, oh yeah, right, that makes sense. it all just kind of fit nicely with my worldview anyway. And then by the time the internet came, I wasn't a total pioneer, but that was about the time that I started my own little conspiracy subculture. Was GeoCities back in the day. It would have been before your day. Do you remember GeoCities?
I remember GeoCities.
Right. So you never know, you might have come across my website. Although
Yeah.
2003, yeah, I think I was going under this name, Jason Wynn, still. Oh no, I'd just done Lucid View, so I created this ALS Cephas persona. Because I
Well,
did,
you know, in
yeah.
some ways, it's a, you know, it was real, when I was in high school, in junior high, I was real big into horror movies, you know. I'd watch every single one I could, you know, just
Right, me
like,
too. Yeah.
and I feel like that's, that was, that, this was an extension of that because, you know, what's more terrifying than a horror movie is if it's true, if it's all true, you know? So it's like that
Absolutely.
same, it's that same jolt of like, oh my God, everything is, you know, the
That's funny because,
blackest, darkest it could possibly be.
right, well, it's Lovecraft, you don't even doubt, but it's funny you say that because after I read Castaneda, I said to this girl, it's all true. Well, everything you've seen in any horror movie, it's true. She's like, eh, I don't know about that.
It's like, Jason, they contradict each other. It's like, yes, exactly.
So, I guess you know about Jimmy Savile and the
Oh yeah.
UK stuff, right? I mean,
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's like, so you know, keep this as in your back pocket, this kind of history, and you're like, all right, well, you know, it's fun to read about. You gotta take it with a complete grain of salt. The people writing this are, you know, a lot of the time not great writers, and you know, I definitely equate good writing with good thinking, and you know, so you see a lot of contradictions and holes, but then something like this comes out and you're like, well shit man, you know, like
yeah.
we should, you know, and it just makes you, it sends you into a tizzy, just a great black hole of like, you know, we are not investigating things we should be with the tools that we don't have, the tools to do it. They're not there. Power protects itself, you know. So
So, and then there's a corresponding reaction to that, which is that subcultures do come up, and then people who are maybe less qualified or less rigorous end up becoming the spokespeople for these things. Such as mentioning names, because I do mention names, David Icke, who I have some affection for, and of course he can take a lot of credit now for having talked about Jimmy Savile and all these other stuff before it was widely known. But at the same time, I feel as though those guys and that culture, that subculture, creates a context for it, which is actually insufficient, let's say. So when you're talking earlier about the bad guy, the history having bad guys suddenly, that's the Ikey and Alex Jones context, right?
definitely.
And people do like that. I mean, it simplifies things and it explains the world in a way that fits with our love of stories.
Right, and you're not the bad guy. If somebody else is, you know, you're not the one that is, you know what I mean? There's that split. There's like a secret world above you, and you're, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's very, and the scapegoat mechanism is the
Yeah.
thing René Girard wrote about. So that's fundamental to societies, is having a scapegoat. So, but I don't think it's accurate. I mean, the scapegoat, we need an a scapegoat is accurate, but the interpretation of history that allows for the occult, but then kind of posits or imagines that this particular group or series of groups or arrangement of groups that are working darkly behind the scenes and screwing everything up, I don't think is quite as accurate in the end. Because it seems as though, or either if it is, or if it is, it seems as though we have to go so far back that
You're doing
we,
Alan Moore shit, yeah.
huh?
You're doing Alan Moore shit at that point, you know. Like, have you read Jerusalem or Voices from the Fire? That's a
Voices
pretty,
from the Fire. That is it Voices from the
yeah.
Fire?
It just came out a couple years ago, I guess. But he just took his own village and he like looked into the deep occult past of it.
Is it
I'm sure.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, Alan Moore. No, it's a
Okay.
novel.
Yeah. I'd misheard when you said the name. Yeah, of course I knew Alan Moore. I know Alan Moore. Watchmen was one of the most formative cultural artifacts for me, because I was like 20 when Watchmen came out, and it coincided with Talking Heads' album, which has Mr. Jones on it. So we're back to that. Naked, which was a kind of musical contemplation about the end of the world, at least that's how I understood it. And Watchmen, of course, is about the end of the world being socially engineered, or like a false end of the world being socially engineered. So those two together, like, compound it. Actually, there were three things. There was a channel work called Starseed Transmissions by Ken Carey, I think his name was, which was basically one of those early New Age things, saying, yeah, we're heading into the New Age and this is what it's going to be like, la da da. So those three together, like, compounded for me that, yes, I'm living in the end times. I became totally committed to an apocalyptic outlook, and I partially credit Alan Moore with that. But anyway, carry on.
Oh no, that's all I had to say. It was that it was, doing that deep history of like the occult is a fictional project.
Yeah,
They're doing
we're from hell as well.
yeah, from hell,
Yeah.
but it's so thrilling to be able to weave actual historical fact in with, stuff that's right. It's maybe not made up, but it's right there on the edges of what's believable, and putting it all together into a package, and then that package, because the idea of like real, of raw, like data-driven history is also not believable because it lacks the human and it lacks the nuances of why people do things at all. But
There's a psycho historian called Lloyd DeMaus. Have you ever heard of him?
I haven't.
He pointed out, just in reference to what you just said, that of all, thousands of books written about war and why war happens, the word anger is almost never used.
Yeah, sure. Oh yeah. Because that's yeah. I don't know why. I don't know why. But yeah, that's a really good point. I just finished reading the second book of the Civil War by Shelby Foote, which is highly recommended. But it's just troop movements. A lot of the times, it's like troop movements and the weather. And yeah, and it's very clinical. It's very interesting because you see the sort of people who are driven to be generals or who are excel at this, and maybe that's why it's not mentioned, because they're not the type of people that get angry. That's more of a political thing. I don't know. I don't know.
Right. Well, so no, I mean, of course, if you're an American president and you're pushing for some foreign policy in Afghanistan or Iraq or anything, you're not going to say, I'm really angry with those motherfuckers. Let's burn their asses. Although there is a little bit of that, like they play with that a little bit. But my point is that they have to sell war on a rational basis, not on an emotional basis. So to acknowledge, maybe even to themselves, to acknowledge that anger is behind it. Is kind of would disrupt the crucial fiction that the war is actually justified.
And I guess behind anger, if you believe Master Yoda, is fear, right? So then you're talking about that, and then all of a sudden your whole culture is suspect, If everybody's just afraid in your society, how do you fix that? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I'm not a big one on solutions myself. I mean, bring it back to the we're saying about history and the dark and the bad guy. What I've just been working on this piece about my own family history. It's called Occult Yorkshire, and it because my grandfather was a founding Fabian. There's a Fabian Society with George Bernard Shaw and Sidney Webb and H.G. Wells and all these very influential literary types, generally, but also political. They formed the Labour Party in Britain, so they were very influential. I mean. Unacknowledged just how deeply influential they've been in our culture, American culture also, and the education system. I was mentioning that John Taylor Gatto writes about how they infiltrated or shaped the education system. But anyway, what was my point? That my grandfather was part of that to some extent. So I started looking more into my family background. So that led to more into the Fabian thing, and that one thing led to another, and the more I've uncovered, the more I've had to consider that the darkest occult conspiracies, if we're going to call them that, are driven by people who are trying to solve society's problems.
Yeah, that follows. No, that definitely follows. I mean, because that's people who are going to be... Because, you know, the thing that I always run up against when I consider the possibility of a conspiracy being true, the outside chances, how much energy it would take, you know? Mm-hmm. And how... I know a lot of smart people, and they do other things with their time, you know? Because it's so much... It would require such a sustained... you know, amount of focus, right? And what can, you know, I don't know if malice can gen up that much energy, you know?
No.
I think something that can is the belief that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
The belief that what you're doing is for the, you know, to solve the world's ills, you know? Yeah, so that follows. I'd buy that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then the good guys turn out to be the bad guys.
Yeah, or, you know, the good guys turn out to be less good than they would have liked to be, and I don't know about it. If they're doing terrible, if the things that they do result in terrible things for society, then...
Not so much society, I mean, society, who knows about society?
Yeah, individuals.
But for individuals, yeah.
Yeah, and then those resonate out there, and, you know, yeah. It's a good point to make. It's a point that should be made often, I think, for sure. That unintended consequences are something you got to consider whenever you're trying to do something and you're not taking your... It's ends before means or whatever, you know?
Well, it's the end justifies the means, yeah. That's the overriding principle, I think, of these things.
What kind of school did you go to then? Was it? Did you go to private school or public? Or, I guess it's our first meeting, right, in England.
In England, yeah. Isn't that confusing? What is that about? I went to public school in England, which means I went to private school. It was paid. I went to two, actually. One of them, I found out recently, was a Fabian-type school. It was a progressive school. And it was mixed. It was a boarding school. And I only lasted two terms there. I didn't really... get on very well. I didn't like being away from home. And yeah. It was quite a weird school. I mean, I have some weird memories there that I can't really explain. So I'm not sure what went on at that school, if something did. And then after that, I ended up at a more conventional kind of public-private school, which is, have you ever seen the movie If with Malcolm McDowell?
I haven't.
Well, if you'd seen that, that would give you an idea. So boys in uniform who get caned and do army training once a week and just that whole weird British thing.
Yeah.
Hated it. Absolutely
Yeah.
hated every hour of that school.
Were people into it at all? Was there like some section of kids at the school who were like, yeah, this is right. This feels good. I like this.
No, I don't think. I mean, I think there must have been because, but I didn't know them. I mean, because you had prefects when I didn't stay long enough to be a prefect, but you get to another level, then you can become a prefect, and that's like you're one of the prison guards, right? You get promoted. So those kids must have been into it.
Maybe, I mean, yeah, I don't know. That seems horrible, man. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I got over it. I think I benefited from it. And again, the more I'm looking at this hidden history, which actually a lot of it isn't hidden, it's kind of out there. It's just people don't pay attention or they don't believe it. But in terms of education and the way it was set up, that Gary was talking about this, the Prussian schooling system, which was designed specifically in order to control people's behavior and prevent people from thinking their own thoughts, to prevent free thinking. That was the basis behind the design of the Prussian schooling system, which had it was compartmentalization, so all the subjects were separate. Classes were broken up into hours, and then the bell would ring after a class. So there's sort of that Pavlovian thing where you're constantly being trained to follow set structures. And everything's taken out of its context, so it's not really meaningful. And I'm just kind of improvising now in terms of I haven't read much about the Prussian schooling system, but the basic
I
point.
think we should all imagine what the Prussian schooling system was
And
like.
the basic point being that it's just to, strip people of their individuality. Well, that is exactly how I experienced school. I experienced every day that this is what they were trying to do, and it actually strengthened my sense of individuality. I mean, in not in an entirely positive way, because it's negative identity. Like I became more of a rebel than would be healthy for my own, was healthy for my own individuation, let's say. But still, in some sense, it was probably better for me than if it had been less conformist and I'd been able to just sort of, adjust myself to fit in. I couldn't. I absolutely couldn't.
Did you have close friends? I mean, I guess everybody does, but did you have close friends at school? Was it?
I had one. Well, I had a couple. I mean, I had more than a couple. I had about four, but I had one really good friend. And we just hung out pretty much alone together. We'd go to the graveyard at lunch and hang out in the graveyard.
But it was all boys' school, right? You're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So.
I don't know if I could deal with that. I think that would drive me crazy. I think I would need like ladies around, man. Like I mean, not for just different ways of looking at the world, you know.
Well,
If I'd been oh God, man, school would have been crushingly
well,
terrible.
it was, well, I don't know if it crushed me, but it was really hard to get out of bed every day, really, really hard, and just face that every day. Was like a mountain in that way. But I don't know. I mean, it seemed to me I was never meant to like school. I was never meant to have anything but a horribly oppressive experience at school, and in a way that prepared me for the But that's my rather perhaps jaded point of view. I don't know.
I'm only interested because you said you come from like a family who's, you know, I guess like been so instrumental in manufacturing the school system, you know, sort of
They
a.
weren't directly instrumental. My family was involved with kind of reform movements, so the campaign for nuclear disarmament, the peace movement. My grandfather was directly involved in that. So more that and civil liberties, and you see, and this weirdly overlaps with the paedophile information exchange, which came about in the 70s, and Jimmy Savile and the systemized sexual abuse. It's actually intimately entangled with these leftist reform movements that my family was involved in. So hit back again to the people who are trying to do good seem to be working consciously or not in tandem with the people who are committing the most horrific crimes, that we
Although
know of.
to push back on that, then, you know, maybe it's that the people who are doing the most good are most susceptible to being infiltrated by or covering up for or, you know, not suspecting, you know, really powerful core predators, you know. Maybe they're just able to, you know, somebody like Jimmy Savile sees, like, oh, okay, well, this group is going to be a lot, you know, less likely to catch on to me than, you know, a bunch of car dealers or, you know, a bunch of stock
brokers. I think it definitely makes a better cover, but I don't, using my family's example, they certainly weren't kind of naive or trusting people. They're businessmen, so powerful, you know, powerful, controlling people. So, yeah, I think it's more about it being a good cover for that. But I also think there's something deeper here maybe we could get into, which is the Jekyll and Hyde thing. Because, you know, I mean, you know about satanic ritual abuse, I presume. You came across that. Well, a lot of the accounts suggest that the satanic ritual abusers, the so-called Satanists, are Christians in their daily life. And that it's not necessarily even a deceit thing, but it may even be a multiple personality, that they have one personality. This isn't funny, but it's making me laugh. They have one personality that's a Christian, and then you have this dark altar that is the satanic ritual abuser. And those two kind of sustain each other, those two sides.
Yeah, I mean, shit, you know. And then maybe like a layer of drugs in between, you know, keep you from getting in touch with it, whether it's like prescribed pharmaceuticals or alcohol.
Yeah.
The darkness, Chase.
So let's put a bit of attention on what you do, because you haven't talked about that at all. Like, what? Tell me what you do. I mean, I know a little bit, but as if I didn't know anything.
Well, I mean, I'm a fiction writer, I guess, primarily. That is my passion and what I enjoy doing. I like writing stories.
Mm-hmm.
I do some performance of the stories as well, I guess. So those two things are what I do.
What kind of performance?
I do shows in bars pretty regularly, a couple times a month. And then, you know, I go through periods of recording stories and putting them on the internet, just like recording readings.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, as far as creatively, that is my bag.
You have something else though, because you play around with media as well, don't you?
I do think it's. I mean, there's sort of a crisis in publishing. Where nobody knows how to deal with the fact that the internet exists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't either. And we can, you know, right? It's like, we can all read anything we want for free. How do we, you know, stay alive as writers and keep making money?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any answers to that, but I do enjoy trying new things out. And so I've done some stuff like put short stories in special custom flash drives, and I've made, you know, as you've done, as Crucial Fictions is, sort of like websites dedicated to one book that, you know, have all the resources, MP3s, and all together up there for people to experience.
Hmm.
I think we're at some sort of liminal time right now with respect to publishing, where we can try all sorts of new shit and people will go along with you for a little bit and, you know, are willing to try it out. I still love books, you know. I like the feel of a book.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I don't consider them to be competing in that sense, because the experience, not to state the obvious, but the experience of lying down and reading a book is completely almost the opposite of seeing it in my computer. I mean, it's almost like yin and yang modes, because even if I'm reading at a computer, I'm still in active mode and I'm hopping from one thing to the other. I don't do it to relax. I wouldn't read on the computer to relax, whereas I would read a book expressly in order to relax. Like, I'm reading Marianne Faithfull's autobiography now because there's some overlap with family history, so I've got a reason to read it. But also, it's very easy to read, and so, oh, great, I can actually just shut down for a little while without watching any TV shows, which I try to limit It's a yeah, because I'm too freaking frenetic to meditate, as I guess you probably are by looking
Yeah,
at
that's what I try, I set a timer and then wait for the timer to end. So I
I did
meditated.
that for a while,
Yeah.
yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, for me, meditation is reading a book, it's losing myself there. Gives me, I assume, some of the same benefits of chilling out.
Well, I think I mean, you could even extend this to TV shows to some extent, but for the body to be in a really relaxed place without being asleep, I think that is helpful and healing. And I mean, a lot of people meditate. They sit in a very uncomfortable position and they stay there without moving as long as they can. And it's sort of self-torture. Maybe it works for some things, but it sure as hell doesn't seem very relaxing to me.
Yeah, also there's it's like goal oriented, right? I mean, you're just trying to achieve enlightenment, right? Or I mean, I say that, but nobody really knows what that means, so it's kind of
Except the
gives you
ones who say they do, so
but yeah, so that's what I do, right? I write stories. A lot of my stories are kind of science fiction-y in nature. More often than not, they just kind of use science fiction as a way to get at other things, just because I usually come up with a science fiction idea. It's like, it's never flying cars, but let's say it's flying cars, right? And it's like, oh, flying cars, great. And I'll write a story about flying cars, and then I sit down and try to write a story about flying cars, and that's a paragraph. So the story then becomes about, some sort of human interaction or people doing trying to do a thing, or how flying cars are fucking up somebody's day. It's
Right.
I can't write a real typical science fiction story. I just don't have it in me. I can't write hard sci-fi, I guess, is what it is. I just don't have the patience or the scientific background, I
Do
think.
you enjoy reading hard sci-fi?
I do, actually. I mean, not exclusively. I like reading everything, but when it's got such a formality to it, it's its own special thing, It's really hard ass and rigorous, and it's so fake, It's like not the way the world works at all, But for that reason, I kind of like getting into the mind of somebody who does think that way. Like, if only things were reasonable and made sense, we would, be living on Mars right now. It's like, yeah, man, I'm sold,
Well, that's
I'm with.
to bringing us back to the previous subject. That's the basis for for social engineering, from what I can see,
Yeah,
is
right.
a purely scientific outlook.
Oh yeah, which is so wrong, but it's naive, but also kind of beautiful and to read as a book. I mean, I would hate to live under the totalitarian rule of such a science fiction hard sci-fi writer. I think that would be bad news. That would be probably the worst ruler you could have. Yeah, is a hard sci-fi
Well,
writer.
I think Aldous Huxley was involved in that. I mean, I think Brave
Yeah.
New World was him just playing around a little, relaxing a bit by writing a
Oh
fiction
yeah.
while he was working on the real thing.
Oh sure, yeah.
So, but your stuff sounds much more friendly, Philip K. Dick kind of a human story
Yeah.
with lots of weird shit
Love Philip
flying
K.
around.
Love Philip K. Dick. Yeah, and I spent two whole collections just writing about sex, I think it's just not plumbed, the depths of it are not plumbed enough, and as far as applying, I guess, science fiction-y, spiritual, futuristic, ideas to it in a way that's not, trying not to be too icky, but also as icky as makes sense to me at the time. I don't know, man. Like I write messed up stuff for the internet. Sometimes it works. More often than not, it doesn't. And I try again,
So one of the things I read by you, I think it was the only one I see so far, was the you sent me the link to the different movies. So, for example,
Yeah.
the Age of Ultron, It was a story of a guy who has debts and he's not able to pay his bills, so he plans to go into the bank, get really sick before he goes into the bank, so he's actually able to throw up. And in the bank, he encounters these holograms, these superheroic holograms, and interacts with them, including the Hulk. And I was actually surprised by how human friendly your future bank was. It seemed more human friendly than our present banks, potentially.
Oh yeah, isn't that the model though? Isn't that where they're going? I feel like Bank of America is gonna merge with, well, that's the whole point of the story, is gonna merge with Marvel, you know,
Right.
and try to really, because you know banks are all about protection, right? The idea of feeling safe and protected, you know, like, and who's gonna protect your money more than the Hulk and Captain America and Iron Man and I don't know, and also Bank of America funded the Marvel
Right.
movies. So
Didn't know
I
that.
don't know, that's yeah. There was this whole capital deal that they did to bail out Marvel right before, and then eventually they sold it over to Disney, but Bank of America, Merrill Lynch rather, kind of got in there and kept the Marvel franchise alive, and I think was responsible for the first couple successful Marvel movies, which I think's kind of, I don't know. I feel like superheroes should not be owned by banks, but you know, controversial.
Yeah, sure. It's like the CIA making
Yeah.
Argo and so on and so forth, that whole thing. So just bringing back to the story quickly then, did
Oh.
you was that a situation that you were in at the time? I mean, how was the
Yeah.
non-fiction, was the autobiography in palpably in that story?
Yeah, definitely. I had my bank account frozen in the middle of winter, and it was horrifying because I don't really have ID, and so it was hard to get it unfrozen. And so I was dealing with people at the bank and people at the lawyer. It's because when your bank account gets frozen, and you're in Canada, right? Yeah, so. America, they in the middle of nowhere, you cannot access your money, right? And you may need to pay rent or eat a meal or whatever, but you're not warned. You just now have no access to your money. It's not like I had a shitload of money in there. I just had a grand or two, but I also needed to pay rent. So it's just like trying to get it unfrozen meant just a massive amount of getting things notarized and going to the bank and having lawyers call other lawyers, and you know, you have to. And it was all for a medical debt from like, you know, 5 years ago. And it was so silly and it was just nightmarish, man. I guess that's another thing probably you don't have in Canada is medical debts.
I don't
So.
personally, but I'm kind of the exception to any rule you could name mostly. So I don't have medical insurance, and I never go to the doctor,
Oh.
and I don't do any of that stuff. I do have a bank account, however, and a
Yeah.
mortgage, so I'm not exactly off the grid. But anyway, I do know these stories. I mean, my father, and this is back in the day, I'm sure it's no better. He got really, really sick while he was in the U.S., and it was winter, and he staggered into a hospital, and they were help treating him, and then they asked who's going to pay this, and he said, "I don't know," and they threw him out. They literally dropped him on the sidewalk in the snow.
Damn. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the most catastrophic issue of our day is like healthcare in America. It's like up there with like slavery. Like if somebody was like, you know, got into office and another half of the country seceded so that we wouldn't all have free healthcare and another war started, I would not be surprised. It's like it's so weird and it's so awful, and it just makes people live their lives completely in a way that I think is the reason why people are so afraid of and distrustful of and don't understand America. But that's like it's part of the answer is you don't know if, you know, if you get sick, like, you know, you might not be able to afford the antibiotics that you need, you know, or the antibiotics that you can afford will cause you not to be able to buy some other shit, you know. It's like it's really messed up, and let's not even talk about like cancer or something that's actually, you know what I mean? It's just, it's insane. That's why other civilized countries have, you know, universal healthcare.
Well, you say that, and I'm going to start sounding like I've just got one drum to bang here, but the National Health Service in the UK, the more I've looked into it, the more I see it doesn't seem entirely coincidental that Jimmy Savile had complete free rein in those places to abuse anyone he wanted to. Like, it seems to be almost in there at the inception of the National Health Service was part of a program by which to gain access to children and helpless people in order to exploit them. I'm just throwing that out there. It's a pretty dark view.
Sure, but it's not like you can't do that in a private healthcare system.
Well, that's true too.
It's not like you can't. I mean, if you can start your own, you know, fucking hospital and, you know, like make it. I mean, is that better than hospitals being run by like,
no,
Catholics?
I mean, think about maybe the lesser of two evils, or just the grass is always greener. Or, I mean, my mother, for example, she volunteered in the National Health, in the Royal Free Hospital, so she worked there for years. And I never got a bad impression of these places myself, but she had stomach problems, and she had several checkups through the NHS, and they all said, no problem, nothing to worry about. And it got worse and worse. So finally she paid to private, and then they said, you have stomach cancer. So it's like, what's the National Health Service really doing at that point? I mean, that raised the question, like, how much of it is just a kind of sugar pill for the masses?
I mean, still though, like, the problem is I can't prescribe myself sugar pills. I mean, I may know what I need, you know what I mean? Like, if I just need some, you know, antibiotics to deal with strep throat, you know, like, I can't buy that myself. There's a whole, like, system in place to keep me from getting that, and it requires health insurance, it requires, you know, you to go see a doctor, you know, I mean, and they're making a shitload of money off it.
They are.
I don't know. So... I hear what you're saying, you know, like, I don't know the abuses of the national, I'm sure there's abuses everywhere, but that's one of those things that it's like the old question of slavery though, right? Like, is it worse to be a slave or is it worse to, like, be an indentured servant in a factory, you know? They're both shit, you know, like, that sucks. Like, but I guess probably, you know, in the end, like, you'd rather be an indentured servant in a factory than actually be owned by another human being.
Well,
although again, slaves get healthcare.
Yeah,
slaves get healthcare.
Of course, again, we're not playing on the full deck because where do we get the information from? A lot of it comes from the same system that's selling whatever product latest version of slavery it is, saying this isn't slavery, that was slavery, right?
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to get into slavery because I already got into trouble with my blog for appearing to defend slavery by barely mentioning that it might not have been quite as bad as we're being told it is now, and it may not be quite as great to be wage slaves or indebted students today. It just seems that the more things change, really, it's just that the ruling class continue ruling.
That we can agree on, that we can for sure. And, you know, then it just becomes like a knife fight at the bottom to try to, like, get the minimum amount of things you need to live, you know. And it's a very entertaining knife fight, I assume, for those who are watching, so, yeah.
My house was built like a drunk construction, slowly raised by a bunch of slackers.
sleep. Can you tell me, my friend, where can I get some red wine? Yeah, the sun was blind, and as they poured the foundation, they were having a good time.
So tell me about these fish behind you.
Oh, yeah, so I'm doing this thing where I'm writing a novel. It's like my third novel in this series of books, kind of sci-fi psychic books or whatever, and it's the third book into a series, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, have you ever written like a fiction series?
No.
Or a series of books, I guess?
No.
Well, you have an idea, and you're like, I'm going to write, like, Harry Potter or something, right? I'm going to write all these books, and it's going to be great, you know? And you write the first one, and you're like, okay, first one's out, and then, you know, maybe you write the second one. And if those didn't succeed, if there's not a lot of people reading them, the justification to keep going, you know, is like major diminishing returns, because it's like, who is going to read this, you know? Nobody read the first two, like, and I'm going to write a third, or I'm going to spend like a year writing the third book in this series, you know? It just feels like horrible, you know? Because it's like walking into the snow, you know, like without any provisions or whatever, and just like walking further and further into the snow alone.
So you planned this as a trilogy, and you've already published the first two?
I planned to add seven books. So I've written the first two, and I'm working on the third one, and it's slow going. So in order to keep myself remembering that it matters, and that, like, you know, every piece of it is, you know, still important, it's a thing that's done in the world, I guess, is I'm drawing like a picture of a fish for every 1,000 words I get through. Mm-hmm. So on the back of my wall here, you're seeing 60,000 fish. To just kind of remind me that, you know, at least something came of it.
60,000 or 6,000?
Or 60 fish, 60 fish.
Yeah, 60 fish, right.
Representing 60,000.
That's the minimum, right, you can get away with for a novel, right?
Boy, yeah, but it's going to be like 120, I think, so we're about halfway done. So.
Oh, okay.
It's a work in progress.
So, and why fish?
I don't know, fish, there's a lot of different kinds. You can keep drawing them pretty much forever, and you'll never draw the same one. You know, there's a lot of different fish out there. I guess you could do the same thing with people, but fish formerly have really interesting body types that are fun to draw. Plus, I can, I don't know, fish. I like fish.
Are there any eels up there?
Yeah, there's an eel, probably. Yeah, there's one.
I think I can see an eel.
Gymnothorax funibris. I think that's probably a moray eel, yeah.
So is this a sort of reward that you give yourself at the end of 1,000 words?
Yeah, it's kind of a reward I give myself after I've written 1,000 words. Just, yeah, definitely. Draw a fish and put it on the wall and then feel better
and
about
the fish,
it.
Does fish feature in your novel series?
They don't, you know. It's nothing to, I mean, it's
a non sequitur.
Non-sequitur, yeah. But then again, you know, the whole process of writing fiction is a dive into the giant unconscious well, and the ocean is a pretty good metaphor for that, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And, you know, going in and writing something is kind of a lot like fishing. You're patient, and you bait your hook and try it and hope something comes along, and maybe it's something you can eat, and maybe it's a moray eel.
Maybe it's something that will eat you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there you go. So there's surely some kind of deeper meaning that can be offered.
Yeah. Well, it's also very, it makes it more sensory, the fact that your book is somehow spilling out into this other realm and covering your walls in this kind of non sequitur fashion, but still.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's keeping me going, so I'm not going to question the magic spell. We'll see if it works when it's over, and I feel good about this book.
Is it the first time you've done this method?
In order to get through various books, I've tried different things, you know. Short stories are my passion. I really love writing short stories. I really like the the way you can hold an entire story in your head and, you know, get it out there and really get what you want to say out there the way you want to say it, you know. Craft it, and it's meticulous. It's like a glass castle, you know, that you've built, and it's like a figurine or something. It feels like you can get close to perfect with a short story. With a novel, man, there is none of that feeling at all, right? It's like you've read a novel. Right?
I just finished a novel, and it's if I was effective, I don't know yet. No one's read it yet, and I've been struggling with it for decades, in a sense. I mean, I've tried a few times and given up, and just struggling with the idea, really, of can I write fiction? You know, will I be able to reach more people if I write fiction? And it's a science fiction thing, yeah, possibly part of the series. I mean, I consider that a possibility. But I wrote it very fast, which might be annoying for you to hear. I don't know. But I find it a bit, I'm not sure if I can trust doing it that fast, but I also don't have very much patience with writing. I really like to get things done and then move on to the next thing. I'm kind of like this musician I talked to on a podcast once. He called himself a sausage factory. I'm a bit like that. I just like to keep producing things. So I don't think I could ever write a novel the way that, say, Jonathan Leetham does. He takes a couple of years, and then the reworking and the polishing and the editing. I just don't think I have the patience for that. And I don't know if that means I won't be able to, you know, write. Well, I certainly won't be able to write that kind of novel. But how about you? I mean, how long do you spend on a novel?
It takes me about a year to write a book. And then probably about another 6 months to edit it. Which I actually really enjoy. People will hate the editing. I really. That's when books come alive, yeah. You know.
Well, one thing I found, I don't know if you'll relate to this, where I was working on this novel that felt like I was maybe getting to something real, was that I found it quite anxiety creating. Like I needed to be somewhere really warm and comfortable to start writing. I always write by hand to begin with. So I would get in bed with a hot water bottle and when there was nobody around, my wife was at work, and that was, I needed the most safe kind of environment to write in, which I've never had that with when I write. Most of my stuff is nonfiction. And the other thing I noticed was that when it was really on a roll, and it was even more than nonfiction, I couldn't write fast enough because the story was coming too fast for me to write it down, so I could hardly read my own handwriting. And so when it was like that, I began to feel anxious about losing that thing, whatever it was.
That feeling where you're like overwhelmed and it feels good and you're like cooking,
yeah,
right?
The flow, yeah. Like where's it coming from? I didn't know, so I didn't know how to be sure that it would be there every time I went back to it. Do you get that?
Yeah, definitely. Although, to me, I feel like that's the moment when I usually stop. Because when I'm feeling that energy of it's like good and it's cooking, that means my imagination's going really well, you know? But that doesn't necessarily mean my prose is gonna, that's when my prose falls to shit, you know? Because I'm just spewing, right. You know? At that point, I'm just like writing things down without, and it feels really good. It's like more automatic, but I usually stop and I'm like, okay, well, I've got myself into the mode where I'm in it, you know, I'm imagining, and I will imagine for another day, you know, now that I'm there again, then I'll come back tomorrow and I'll sit down and I'll be more measured and get it,
right.
You know?
So you like, stop writing and just carry on imagining internally.
Yeah, because then that's you know, a lot of the reason why I'm doing it in the first place is so I can stay in that state where I'm imagining something all the time and something that I like, you know, or that is interesting to me or does something for me deeper down, mm-hmm. You know. I feel like, and that's what makes novels difficult, is because it's a long process. With a short story, it's like, you know, okay, I did it, you know, it maybe takes a month or whatever, but you get done with it, and you're like, that was the thing I met with a novel, it doesn't let go, you know, you're doing it for a long time, if that's your process, you know, so you're just in this thing, slogging along, imagining this universe, or this place, or these people, and how they relate to each other, and it can affect your life in ways that are good and bad, you know, because you're not relating to other people as strongly as you might want to, and you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
But
I'm autistic, quote unquote. So, what you mean? So, do you feel a responsibility then to the things that you're creating, not necessarily just the characters, but the world and the characters that you're creating? Is there a sense of responsibility to that?
Yeah, definitely, right? Since you did this thing, you wanted to, not only to the characters, but you imagine sort of like that somebody, you know, like a close, kind of skeptical but also on board person is with you at all times, you know, no matter how deep into the story you're editing, they're still on board and paying attention. So you have a responsibility to them, right? To make it good, to make it still be something.
So who are these people, sorry?
Just an ideal person. Like, no, it's not anybody in
particular. The hypothetical reader.
Yeah. Hypothetical reader, right. Yeah. Or, you know, a very non-hypothetical reader that you know, maybe your friend or your girlfriend or your wife or, you know, somebody you're writing for, or, you know what I mean? Like, that, I feel a responsibility for them as well. So, I mean, reading is its own creative act too, and I feel like you have a duty to readers when you're writing something, you know, and you know, they're the sort of person, they're reading fiction that gets something out of fiction, you know, they get something personal to them, right? So you have to, and if you've spent your entire life trying to be a good fiction writer, you know, like you've used all these resources trying to get to this point, you know, you're their drug, you're their, the thing that they, you know, and I read a shitload of books, you know, I feel I'm a reader as well as I am a writer,
sure.
So, you know, I understand that feeling, and so I definitely keep readers in mind when I'm writing, as far as that goes.
Right. So those two feelings of responsibility, then, are they, is one stronger than the other, or do they intersect? Because I don't so much relate to the responsibility to my readers.
Responsibility, it's more of an awareness. Yeah.
I'm curious, because I don't so much have that feeling of responsibility to the reader, at least I didn't when I was working on this novel. I don't think I do generally. But I did have this really, really strong feeling of responsibility to the characters in the story, which felt almost I don't know what terms to put it into, but it was relating also to the anxiety of kind of losing the thread. It was as though, I tried to talk about this with Gary, and it's difficult without it coming off as pretentious or kind of self-aggrandizing, but it was as though there was this sense that...
You seem pretty self-aggrandizing.
I hope you're being ironic now. Maybe I lose the thread. I'll put it this way. I'll use the example that I put in the novel, because part of the novel is I write about the process of writing the novel, so it's a kind of meta-novel or liminalist thing, so I include the act of writing the novel in the story itself and in the characters. So I wrote about how, I've forgotten what the example was now, damn it.
I'm sorry, that's my fault, I'm sorry.
Yeah, completely. What would you do that? I wrote about how, what if, you know, how do I know that this scene that I've just imagined and scribbled down in my notebook in bed with a hot water bottle, how do I know that I wasn't describing something that was actually happening somewhere at that time, or that is going to happen in the future, or maybe happened in my life and I forgot it? You know, how do I know I'm not accessing some sort of memory, even a future memory, and just trying to recreate it or represent it? And therefore that then introduces the possibility of the question of getting it wrong again, this line between fiction and non-fiction. It felt to me like writing fiction, it felt almost more intense, the responsibility of accurately representing the truth, even though I was making it up.
I get that. Yeah. All right. Now that you put it that way, there's definitely that. And maybe that's why I back off whenever I start feeling that flow, because I feel like I might be overwhelmed by the, you know, the possibilities, and I need to get it right. I need to do all the imagining. I need to see it completely before I can come back and write. So yeah, no, that's definitely a phenomenon. That's definitely true.
For me as well. Okay, well, that's confirming. So, what have you thought about it before?
You're not doing it wrong.
Have you thought about it though? I mean, have you questioned like what that could be?
Yeah, you know, is it? I mean, I've certainly, you know, writing science fiction, you're always sort of also under the onus of prophecy as well, right? Like, am I channeling something that, am I in a way that makes sense to me that is, I got to get it right, because if I, you know, I'm getting this feeling from the future, from, you know, I'm able to collate all the possibilities in a way that will lead me to the inevitable correct one in a way that other people aren't trying to do, in which case I have to do it right, you know, because why bother otherwise? This is like some thing that some other world that I'm accessing through the magic power of fiction, in which case, like, if I don't tell these people's stories right, then they're gonna punish me, you know, they're gonna come out sideways.
That's
or something
very like Whitley Strieber, though. I think he actually did fear that, and I think he actually thinks he got punished. That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Mr. Miracle Jones. Part 2 will be up as usual the coming Wednesday, November the 25th, 2015. More about Miracle Jones in the show notes. That's at audiculture.com/liminalist. Thanks to Mark for donating to this podcast.